Okay, this message is entitled The Israel Sign, Biblical Prophecy and End Times, ? Last week we looked at ISIS, and we looked at the proliferation of violence and horrific barbarism and terrorism across the globe, and I'd encourage you, if you weren't here, to get that message. We also looked at a coalition of end-time nations that it would appear is now forming, and based on Ezekiel chapter 38, of Russia, Turkey, Iran, Libya, Ethiopia, Sudan, Somalia. And that's interesting that we see ourselves in a time in the world when these nations are coming together that will eventually seek to annihilate Israel. Today, I want to focus a little bit more on Israel and her history so that we can get a better idea what God is like. So if you're younger and you were born after 1960s, there's some things that are going to be said here today I think don't matter to you, but in fact they do. I'm going to tell you some war stories today. I'm going to tell you some things about the nation of Israel and how God has preserved them over time. But really what I'm talking about today is the way God interacts with you. So I want you to pay attention to that end. It's very important that you understand how God interacts with Israel. Deuteronomy 11 and 12 says this: "It is a land the Lord your God cares for. The eyes of the Lord your God are continually on it from the beginning of the year to its end." God is interested in every person on earth. He is also particularly interested in the nation of Israel, prophetic Israel. And as I said last week, Israel is a geopolitical reference point. In fact, you start reading through the Old Testament, north, south, east, and west, it's all a reference point around the center of the world, which is Israel. A nation not much bigger than New Jersey and not much more populated than Philadelphia. It is the focal point of hatred throughout the region. They are surrounded by people who no longer want them to exist, and have many of which have said so publicly. So we need to pay attention to this morning. What do we learn about Israel over her history that is particularly profound? The first thing we understand about Israel is that they are the receivers of a promise and a divine covenant. You hear about this in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. A promise was made from God to Abram. When he makes a covenant with him in chapter 15, it becomes Abraham, because Abram and Yahweh become one in covenant, Abraham. Even the sound of Yahweh comes into his name. Sarai, his wife, becomes Sarah, because they're now in a covenant with Yahweh. And then in Genesis chapter 17, verse 7, God further articulates that covenant. There is a covenant that has been made, that was initiated with a promise that is irrevocable and is not lessening in intensity. That's the first thing you realize about Israel. The second thing you realize about Israel is that they have received the retribution of the nations. Now, many people have been hated over the years. Many people groups have been hated. There have been atrocities and afflictions and genocide in many different areas of the world. But Israel is unique. You got to hand them this. They are probably hated the most. Anti-Semitism is historic, consistent, and they find themselves in the center point of a bullseye for a lot of the world. There have been great disasters, great difficulties, great atrocities, and incredible retribution, all of which came out of Deuteronomy chapter 31, verses 16 through 17. It's actually a fulfillment of prophecy. Antiochus Epiphanes IV, the abomination and desecration of the temple in AD 70, as Jesus predicted, that not one stone would be left upon another. That's why the temple is no longer in Jerusalem today. The Romans razed it. It's gone. It blew up. All of this, the Holocaust, when 70% of all Jews died during the Holocaust. Now, not just Jews, homosexuals, those with dark skin, a lot of people died. But they're in the center of a lot of atrocities. And they are, as I said, typically the object of scorn for Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, Jordan, Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah, Turkey, and Russia. So Israel has received a promise and a covenant, as have you, and they have been the subject of a lot of retribution and atrocities. The third thing you realize about Egypt is that Egypt was a very barren land, and it actually was prophesied in Ezekiel chapter 36, verse 8 through 10, that it would be repopulated. This is fascinating. It would be repopulated. Now, no people group has ever been scattered across the earth and survived. When you take a people group and you scatter them across the earth, you dilute their customs, you dilute their faith, you dilute their sense of forgiveness, you dilute their sense of family, you dilute their language in a massive way. And eventually, because of cross intermarrying with other cultures and customs, you end up totally desecrating the culture itself and the people group. Well, how did they survive? How do they keep their faith? How do they keep their customs? How do they keep their purpose? How do they keep the covenant? Well, when they returned and repopulated after the Babylonian captivity, that was a prophecy. But when Israel in 1948, on May 14th, declared independence, at the United Nations referendum, they declared independence in a little library in Tel Aviv, and they became a nation state. Israel became a state on May 14th, 1948. That was the beginning of a prophecy being fulfilled to repopulate a land that had just, for the most part, been a bunch of Bedouins and shepherds that were just migrating and feeding off a very dry and arid land that really didn't produce anything. So the scattering of the Jews was not only a prophecy, but the regathering and the repopulation of Israel was very important as well. And this is also a fulfillment of prophecy that Israel is to reestablish on the land. They have their own land now. Post-British World War II opened up the possibility for what was called a partition plan. The partition plan was to give the Jews a certain amount of geography and the Arabs or the Palestinians a certain amount of geography. The Jews accepted the partition plan. The Arabs rejected the partition plan. As soon as they became a nation state on May 14th, with Ben Gurion, the prime minister, signing that declaration, something happened. We'll talk about that in just a minute. At the time that they repopulated the land in 1948, there were 600,000 Jews living in Israel. Today, there's 6 million, 6 million plus. And more are returning every day, also a fulfillment of prophecy. Not only did they repopulate the land, they repurposed the land. In 1850, Mark Twain went to Jerusalem and surrounding area we know today to be Israel. He was hopeful when he got there to see some of the old sites and to get a feel for what it was like in Bible days. Massively disappointed was Mark Twain for a couple of reasons. The land was just dry, it was scrubbed, there was no fruit, there was no harvest, there was nothing in that land that was attractive to be there. There was no water, it was desolate, it was desert dust. In fact, there were swamps where there was water, and in the swamps was rabid malaria. It was the single most unattractive place on the face of the earth. If you go down to the Dead Sea, which is the lowest point on earth, you'll see there's not much there. And there wasn't much there in the 1800s. It's very interesting. Israel is one of the only nations that can say they have more trees today than they did at any other time in their history. They have more trees planted in Israel today than at the beginning of the century. The Jews have repopulated that land, and they have turned those swamps of malaria into the Jezreel Valley. Not only do they feed themselves, they export fruits and vegetables around the world. It is a fertile plain. Their scientific technology, their drip system of irrigation, what they've done with their crops is incredible. Now, the thing you have to learn about Israel, when the people of God populate Israel on the land flourishes. When the people of God leave the land and are scattered, the land dries up. It's the only place on the face of the earth where the land is dependent upon the people who inhabit it. If the Jews are scattered, no crops, no water, and malaria. If the Jews return and they work the land, it is one of the most fertile plains anywhere on earth. Another prophecy is the reviving of the Hebrew language. Zephaniah 3 and 9 says, "For then I will turn to my people a pure language. I will return to them a pure language, and that they may call upon the name of the Lord and serve him with one consent." Though the Jews were scattered around the world, and though the Hebrew language was only preserved in rabbinical teachings and writings, in accordance with Zephaniah 3 and 9, the prophecy has been fulfilled that Hebrew is now the state language in Israel and spoken and written by the people of Israel. That's a fulfillment of biblical prophecy. Now, how difficult is this? Because no other ancient language has ever made it. In fact, no other ancient people have ever made it that have been scattered. But yet, the man who was at the forefront of bringing the Hebrew language back to be its common national language realized that there were things that they had to come up with words for that hadn't even been invented when Hebrew came around. They didn't have a word for car. They didn't have a word for airplane. They had to go back to the root words in the Hebrew language, and they had to figure out words to to get the Hebrew language caught up with the 21st century. Yet another biblical prophecy. Let's review. Israel is a receiver of divine promise and a covenant. They've received the retribution of the nations. They are given in divine promise a reestablishment of the land. They've repopulated the land, and they've repurposed the land. They revive their Hebrew language, and then there is a prophecy that Israel will learn to protect herself, the resurgence of their military. Now, the day that Ben-Gurion signed the Declaration of Independence in Tel Aviv was the day that five nations declared war on Israel. How'd you like that for your first week as a nation? Five nations declared war immediately on Israel. Harry Truman said the greatest thing he ever did in his presidency was to partner with Israel in the signing of that independence declaration on May 14, 1948, in Independence Hall. At the time, they had barely any tanks, very few aircraft, and three-inch mortars. That's it. 600,000 people, not all of them soldiers. And they also had a weapon they called Davidka. They realized that what they did as a nation would be similar to David and Goliath. And boy, is that ever true. So they came up with a bomb that actually had more bark than bite. They didn't have the munitions to create a bomb that would do mass destruction, but they did have a bomb that could make an incredible amount of noise. And it flipped the Jordanians out. They didn't know how to handle the reverberation of the sound of this bomb, and it literally scared them into total confusion. That was the War of Independence. Five nations declare war on the day that they signed the Declaration of Independence. Fast forward to 1967. An impending war known as the Six-Day War, but at the time they didn't know how long it would last. The national parks in Israel were being allocated to be graveyards. The Jews expected themselves to be run into the Mediterranean and the Mediterranean to turn red with blood. The morale was incredibly low. Their prime minister addressed the nation with a lack of confidence, and the end result of his address is they were more confused and scared than when he began speaking. There was a rabbi in New York who addressed a conference. He got a prophetic word from the Lord for Israel, and that recording was played in Israel to the Israeli people days ahead of an inevitable, incredible war that they were not ready for. In that message, they were told that God would be faithful, that they would survive, that there was a covenantal promise that God had for their nation. The people's attitude began to shift. The imminence of war began to increase. They stopped looking at national parks as graveyards, and they started figuring out how they're going to win the war. The rabbi encouraged them each to use tefillin, which is a phylactery. It's a box that a rabbi will put on his head. Soldiers came from their homes. Reservists were called up to duty, and they put phylacteries on their head, and they began to pray as a nation and as a military with the scripture on their forehead in a little box. Even the secular Jews were involved in praying, reaching back into their ancient history to find out if there's a God back there somewhere, could he be present in this war in the days ahead? Assad, senior in Syria, had begun to channel water away from the Sea of Galilee, precious drinking water for the state of Israel. It was declared, it was basically a declaration of war, to channel water away from another nation. President Nasser in Egypt had a buffer between he and the Israelites. It was a UN peacekeeping force. He asked in his braggadocious nature, in his arrogance, he asked the UN peacekeeping force to move themselves out of the way so that they could attack Israel. Not thinking that they would do it, but they did it. Every last one of them left. And now he was faced with his big words and his promise of war. The Israelites were incredibly outmanned. There were 275,000 soldiers in Israel coming up against 400, almost a half a million soldiers attacking them. The enemies had two times as many tanks, four times as many airplanes, And the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, had figured out how to take an airplane and turn it around in a pit stop, refuel it, get the pilot some water in 8 minutes, sometimes six. And on one morning, as their intelligence told them, the night shift of the Egyptian Air Force would land. 30 minutes later, the morning shift would take off. Any military strategist knows that you don't want your Air Force on the ground all at the same time. They're supposed to overlap. The United States did this in the Philippines, and it cost them a lot of men. But the Egyptians had developed this pattern in their arrogance of having all their planes on the ground at the same time at 9:45 in the morning for about a 30-minute time lapse. The Israeli military strategists saw this. They sent a bulk, a third of their planes, to fly 100 feet over the Mediterranean, right for those air bases in Egypt, right over the Sinai Desert. The first wave appeared, and they appeared taking off. They were seen by Jordanian radar posts. And the Jordanians tried to let the Egyptians know that they were about to be attacked. And they used a password, a code word, to let them know that war was imminent, that Israel was attacking, but it was a code word that had been changed the day before. And it was no longer relevant. So the Egyptians never got the message. The anti-aircraft guns in Egypt never, no one can figure out, never ever received an order to fire back at the Israeli planes. 298 Egyptian airplanes were desecrated and their runways by three waves of Israeli Defense Force airplanes. They never got a plane off the ground, and the preemptive attack in the Six-Day War changed the direction of the war entirely. The Israelis had figured out how to cross the Sinai Desert, not using the roads they were expected to travel upon, by letting air out of their jeeps and their military vehicles. They would navigate the sand and not get stuck. The treads on their tanks were modified to handle the sand and the desert. The Egyptians saw these people coming. They were dumbfounded. They had no idea what to do, and they lost the majority of three different airfields. Now, there are testimonies, live testimonies, of one man, one Israeli in a tank, firing all night long at Egyptian tanks in the Sinai Desert. And at day's light, the brigade leader of the Egyptian tank force walking up to that one tank with a white flag in his hand saying, "We surrender," asking that tank operator where the other 50 tanks were that had been firing on them all night long. He says, "I'm all alone." He says, "No, there's at least 40 or 50 other tanks with you." He says, "I'm all alone." This gets back to Gideon's time in the Old Testament, a place where military advisors in Israel find strategic strategies to protect their homeland, by the way. Jordanian soldiers that were attacked by bees during battle. Confusion among the enemy combatants, not unlike Gideon's army. Jews walking into the town of Shechem without resistance as the citizens of Shechem wave at them out their windows, thinking that they were the Iraqi army. Taking whole towns at one time without firing a weapon. I think there are some prophecies that God is bringing to pass by looking out for these Israeli people. There was a man by the name of Eli Cohen. Eli Cohen is a Jew who also worked as a spy. He made his way into Syria and made his way up through the government and came to a very high position of government authority. And when looking at the Golan Heights, which is an incline, if you've been up there with me, you've seen it. There's a big mountain there, and in that mountain are bunkers. And in those bunkers are Syrian weapons and Syrian personnel. And Eli Cohen, the Jewish spy, said, "I feel bad about these Syrian soldiers being out in the sun all day long. Let's plant eucalyptus trees next to them so that at least they have shade." He then called his buddies in Israel and said, "Everywhere you see a eucalyptus tree is where you want to drop a bomb." Minefields had been exposed in sandstorms. Clouds and strange fog descended upon Israeli soldiers when needed, and lifted when the element of surprise was also needed. God's hand is upon Israel in some strange ways, and there are many, many testimonies that you can read about God, how God preserved and protected them. Wheat fields that were as high as they could possibly be weren't expected to be harvested by the Palestinians. The Palestinians never thought the Jews would harvest at a weird time of year. But the tunnels that the Palestinians came out of right next to that field, they came out of those tunnels one day to realize that the wheat had been gone and they no longer had cover because it was a sabbatical year and they actually needed to harvest their crops off of a normal schedule. So Palestinian Arabs, militia, are walking through a wheat field that was just harvested that wasn't supposed to as bombs fall upon them from the air. They could be seen. West Point military strategists will not study the battle tactics in its curriculum of the Six-Day War because they realize that there's pointless. There were miracles. You can't account for those in every battle, but they were evident among the Israelites. The Israelites ended up with four times the amount of land they started with. And remember, they were supposed to be buried in their national parks, and the Mediterranean Sea was supposed to turn red with blood. The Israelites in the Six-Day War had 760 casualties. The soldiers of Syria, Jordan, Egypt, and Iran collectively lost 18,000 men. Israeli people are resilient and prophesied also to be alone. Let me read this to you. Zechariah chapter 12, verse 1 through 5. A prophecy. The word of the Lord concerning Israel. The Lord who stretches out the heavens, who lays the foundation of the earth, and who forms the human spirit within a person declares, quote, I am going to make Jerusalem a cup that sends all the surrounding peoples reeling. Judah will be besieged as well as Jerusalem. And on that day when all the nations of the earth are gathered against her, I will make Jerusalem an immovable rock for all nations. All who try to move it will injure themselves. On that day I will strike every horse with panic and its rider with madness, declares the Lord. I will keep a watchful eye over Judah, but I will blind all the horses of the nations. Then the clans of Judah will say in their hearts, the people of Jerusalem are strong because the Lord Almighty is their God. When you look at the Jewish people and all the Nobel Prize winners, and you look at the technology that they've exported around the world, and you look at the strength of their military, which is arguably probably the third or fourth most strongest military in the world, and you look at its landmass like New Jersey, and its population like Philadelphia, and you look at them being besieged by army after army after army after army, time after time after time, atrocities, Holocaust, and the like, you come to the conclusion that they are a resilient people, but they are not totally alone. And from this, we have something I think we can learn. I find it interesting that Egyptian commanders can give their soldiers orders that are not understood by those who are receiving them. In fact, understood to be opposite. Confusion. And I see this in the world today, do you not? Utter confusion. We talked last week about ISIS and the infiltration and proliferation of ISIS or ISIL. And it's just mass confusion. And not only confusion on the ground, confusion about what's going on the ground. Have you not noticed, do you not look at the news, do you not see a dumbfoundedness in the world today? We are stupefied, it seems, as to how to deal with certain things. We are like dumbfounded, confused. I don't know what, no, we lack clarity, we lack decisiveness, we lack action. And this is all surrounding some of the battles that Israel had. And this is something that's been consistent throughout the scripture and throughout time. Well, that's Israel. What does Israel have to do with us? What does Israel have to do with a middle schooler? What does Israel have to do with a couple just married? What does Israel have to do with a church in the United States in the mountains thousands of miles away? What does Israel have to do with you? Well, you, my friend, are even more a receptor of a promise and a covenant than Israel. God has demonstrated his love for you while you were yet a sinner. He died for you. There is a promise. There are promises that have been made to you that are irrevocable and never to be broken, and they're made and initiated by God, and they are not lessening in intensity. They are as equal as intense and intimate to you then when they were made as they are today, and he knew you before you were ever born, and you were being embroidered together in your mother's womb. There's a promise made to you, and there's a covenant made to you. We just partook of this Holy Communion. It's representative of a covenant that has been made. A covenant is something you die to keep. You die to keep a covenant so the other party can maintain the benefits of that covenant. The one who dies to keep the covenant was Christ. He died to keep the covenant. You can't ask more than that. And he rose again from the dead. There's a promise and a covenant made to you by the blood of Jesus Christ, signed by his blood. Second thing that is interesting is that you have received the resistance and the retribution of others. There are people here that have been abused, that have been the victims of atrocities, verbal abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, neglect, all of that nonsense, all of that darkness, that deep, dark, secretive mess that still lingers in the human soul. You know that. Jesus knows that. Many people know that. You've been through difficulties, and for whatever reason, certainly not righteous, you have been the target of an opposition that you didn't deserve. Question, are you left bitter? Are you left quiet externally, but internally chaotic? You know, I told you that Israel took back massive amounts of land that they never had before. You know what they did with that land? They gave a lot of it back. People don't talk about that. But they give a lot of it back to those that seek to destroy them, to maintain peace, and to relieve themselves of a historic bitterness that would actually work as a cancer eating them up from the inside. 1973 on Yom Kippur, when Egypt attacked again, it was the Jews that crossed the Suez Canal into Egypt, backed around their third army, was about to kill them, and ended up giving back to them the Suez Canal and back to them a buffer in the Sinai. When they raised the Israeli flag on the Dome of the Rock, they gave it back to them later. What God does with Israel, he does for us. Who has harmed you? Who has sought to destroy you? Who has neglected you? There's a power in meekness. There's an incredible power in forgiveness. There's a power in letting go. There's a power in disempowering those who sought to hurt you and no longer giving them that power over you. It's huge. It comes by way of this promise and this covenant. Israel reestablished themselves. They were scattered, but they regathered themselves. Hey, there are people in this room, and I know this to be true. I've talked about it with you. You've been scattered. You look back over your life, and you say, I've been in all these different places. I've done all these things. I've been through all of this nonsense. A lot of it was self-imposed. I made some stupid decisions. My life fell apart. I'm finding myself having to start all over again. I got to start all over again. Well, the Jews started all over again after their Babylonian captivity, after Assyrian captivity. They started all over again after 70% of them were wiped off the face of the earth. They started all over again, and now they're the third most powerful military in the world. I know some of you have been scattered, and I know it hurts, and I know you look back more than you look forward, and I know you're confused by why you are where you are in your life. I know you're not where you wanted to be when you were 20, 30, and 40, looking ahead. But neither were the Jews. And the very promise and the covenant placed upon the Jews is even more so upon you. He will set you out of that scattered confusion and repurpose you in your land. There is a blueprint that still exists for the remainder of your life, and God wants you to live it and live it more abundantly. Pick up one day at a time, stop dying one day at a time, start living one day at a time, and call upon the promises and the covenant of God to restore you as a person. You don't have to continue the patterns that have been established in bad marriages and poor upbringings. You don't have to duplicate that to the next generation. God can repurpose your land and make you fruitful. He can take an arid, malaria-ridden swamp and turn it into something beautiful, colorful, vibrant, nutritious, and energizing. If anything I can say to you this morning, for those of you who have been down and you feel like you're out, let me tell you, you were down, but you're not out. Keep pressing on. He's going to bring you along. He's going to put the right people in your life. He's going to purpose you. He's going to teach you. He's going to give you the information you need. He's going to give you the favor. He's going to protect you. Keep pressing on. You'll eventually look more forward than you do back. The Jews do not have much to look back on. And you and I are no different. I'm speaking as one who self-destructed as a human being and imploded upon myself with my own choices, my own lostness, and my own godlessness, and my own rebellion. But that's just a season. That's just a season. There's more ahead. Israel teaches us that. He wants to repurpose your life. You know, there is a purpose, and this is pretty interesting. Within the confines of your faith, in the confines of a church, in a community, with the giftedness that he's given you, there's a purpose for you that some of you are walking in and some of you are not. If you're frustrated about being purposeless in your faith and what your area of ministry is, you are the one who's probably not walking in your area of ministry. Before the service, I was talking with a gentleman. Told me this story of a few days ago. I was in the back of an office building there, and an 18-year-old girl walked up to him. He's an older guy. She started to pull out this track, and she started to witness to him. I was kind of thrown back by it. That's normally what he does. I love it when people witness to me. I love it. Just kind of let them go on. It's great. I love it. But he said, you know, young lady, he says to her, if everyone in Macon County your age was doing what you do, we wouldn't have many problems. He's kind of choked up by it, actually. He was choked up by the idea that this young girl was sharing the gospel with him. So he gave me this tract, you know. He says, when you get a few minutes by yourself, I want you to read it. It's profound, he says. About that, and we'll come back to that in a few minutes. The next thing that God did for Israel was revive their language. One of the coolest things that I enjoy about people that are growing in Christ is when they cuss. I think that's funny. What do I mean by that? You know, when you have somebody who's so raw in their faith, they're so new, we haven't taught them how you're supposed to be yet. And you can tell that their speech isn't where it needs to be. Because out of the abundance of your heart, your mouth speaks, and the heart hasn't been totally touched yet. So you're in that in-between phase. You're kind of like sort of worldly, but you got this new faith growing in you like a little acorn, you know? You're not an oak tree, you're just an acorn, which is just a crazy nut. And what happens is God starts to work on your heart, see? Now the abundance of your heart, your mouth speaks, and your speech changes. Well, God preserved and gave them this pure language back. What's the application for us today? What comes out of your mouth? What comes out of your mouth? Are you disrespectful to your parents? I was speaking to the adults. Are you disrespectful to your parents? That time was for the young people. What comes out of your mouth? There's a promise and a covenant of God says, in relationship with me, let me tell you something. I'm going to temper your language. It's going to be more blessing than curses. It's not going to be a spark that sets a fire, James says. It's going to be uplifting, encouraging. If he could do that for a whole entire nation, you don't think he can do that for a 13-year-old? Those of you in the back nine, and your parents are still alive, are you communicating the way you should? As often as you should? Language. and the resurgence of the strength to fight and defend the purposes of God. Israel had every reason to lay down and die, except one. God was on their side. But they had this resurgence, this let's get up and fight, let's get up and do what we gotta do. There's only one secret weapon in Israel when it comes to war. Fight with all you have or die. That's it. Because everyone hates us and we're surrounded by everyone that hates us. That's it. There's no other option. Do you defend the faith with equal passion? Are you prepared to give an answer? My gosh, this ministry does everything they possibly can do, myself included, to give you the tools you need to defend the faith. Are you picking the tools up and using them? I have 400 videos on lifepoints.org. Go there. Sit down. Listen to a 6-minute video every day for the next 30 days. Figure out how to defend your faith. If you're frustrated about not having a place of ministry, get frustrated about not doing anything about it. Evangelism. I got a challenge today. Is there a middle or high school student here today who will in this moment say to me, as a pastor of this church, I will take this next week. And though I may not have ever done it before, or maybe I've done it not so good, I will share the gospel with one person the next 5 days. Can anybody declare that they would actually do that? Is there a middle or high school student who would step up and say, I will do that? Is there? Why? Why is that? You don't want to know the answer. Well, the answer is because their parents haven't done it for them and showed them how to do it. 1,000 churches were surveyed in the United States of America. The average age of the church was 55. Churches don't start putting ministries on or near college campuses. 15 years from now is going to look very, very different in this country. We can't scramble up a middle or high school student to share the gospel with people because they've never seen anybody do it before. And we got people here in Israel fighting to the death for their faith, most of them secular. We learn a lot, don't we, when we look at groups of people. But when we bring it home, interesting. If I was to say anything to the Jewish people today, it would be this. Get more Jewish. Be more Jewish. Get as Jewish as you possibly can. We're trying to make Christians out of secular Jews. Here you go. Let's make Christians out of Jews who are now Jews and not secular Jews. Get as many Jewish people. I hope somebody out there is listening to me who's Jewish. Get to know the Father. Get to know your heritage. Get to know your biblical prophecy. And getting to know the Father, I'll tell you who he's going to introduce you to. The Son. Because he seems to be the only missionary in the world today doing that. Let's get Jewish people more Jewish. Let's get Christian people more Christian. Let's look at how faithful God, what does God have to do? I mean, how faithful does he have to demonstrate himself until we finally go, hey, he's pretty faithful. I guess I'll do that too. I guess he'll meet me somewhere along the line and he'll help me do it. But you got to get out in the battlefield. You got to pick up a weapon. The battle's not against flesh and blood, it's against the darkness. The effectual prayer of a righteous man availeth much. Effectual and righteous prayer of a righteous woman availeth much. This is what it's come to. The more Cain we raise about the immorality of our country, the more we expose our absence of a witness. For the state of the church is an indictment against the state of the country. Show me a country has a weak church, and I'll show you an immoral country. France, Turkey. Show me the church in Ephesus. It's in ruins. Pergamum, ruins. Smyrna, ruins. Thyatira, ruins. Show me a faithful church, I'll show you a faithful country. Show me a bunch of Christians griping about their country, I'll show you a weak church. The nation is a reflection of the church. And we're having time scrambling up. Israelis scrambled 200 planes. I'm looking for one middle schooler. I'm looking for one high school student that says, you know what? I'm going to take you up on that. I will witness to five people this week. Not because five people is anything special. It's so out of the ordinary, I just picked it. Because it jumpstarts you. People won't do it. There's a verse, Romans 1 and 16. It happens to be the purpose, and the central purpose of the book of Romans. Paul, a guy who had been beaten and flogged and imprisoned, whipped, scourged, he says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation, first for the Jew and then for the Greek. What do we want? What must happen to get the attention of the church in the United States of America? What precipitates some sort of evangelistic zeal? What is it? How big a thing would it have to be? We already know to get people in churches, it has to be 9/11. And we know that last 2 weeks. Something as terror-driven as that, is so immersed in terrorism, can have a two-week effect. How drastic would it have to be in the tribulation period to get a month out of people? It's amazing. Let's make sure that we're not dumbfounded. Let's make sure we're not listless. Let's make sure we're not asleep. What does it take? It's amazing. I see, and you can't tell me there's not people in this community who don't know the Lord. They're standing up in the services on Sunday. We're doing all we can do to walk alongside them, give them the resources, get to know them, sit down with them, pray with them, give them a Bible. We're doing all of it. You can't tell me there's no people here. You can tell me there's nobody willing. You can tell me that. Israel's a nation who had every reason to quit and never did. And God met him somewhere on the battlefield and let a fog rest on him, let a code get mixed up. Showed him how to go through a desert that he created in a way different than the Egyptians did. He figured out how you could take a kibbutz and turn swampland, malaria-ridden swampland, into a fertile plain. But you got to make an effort. You got to meet him somewhere out there in the middle of the desert. You got to get in the tank. You got to pick up a weapon. You got to do something. He meets you, I don't know, if it's 40%, 20%, halfway. He pretty much does the rest. And then the cool thing, he gets the glory. And when he gets the glory, we get another opportunity to do it all over again, to overcome darkness. Is there anybody here today? Is anybody here today that, as others have in recent weeks, you say to yourself, I don't know this Christ of which you speak. I know about him. I've heard his name. You're uncomfortable hearing Jesus as a name. It does bothers you some. I know what that feels like. But you're not in a relationship with him. You're not hanging out. You're not talking. You're not best friends. You're not serving him. More importantly, has this blood that we referenced today covered your sin so that it is now no longer visible to the Father? He no longer sees your sin. He sees the blood of his Son applied to your issue, forgiving you of your sin and separating it as far as from you as the east is from the west. If you're sitting here today and you say, well, I never had that forgiveness of sin, I guess I'm going to heaven. Don't guess, friend. There's only one way to heaven. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes unto the Father except by me. If you don't have a personal, saving relationship with Jesus Christ where you've asked him to come into your heart and become the Lord of your life and forgive you of your sin, there ain't no, I guess I'm going to heaven. You ain't going to heaven. I got to be as clear as you possibly can be in this culture because everybody's got their own idea. That is the idea right there. There's the truth. And the truth will set you free. There ain't no heaven outside of Christ. There ain't no peace either. There ain't no purpose. There ain't no covenant. No promise. You're on your own. I want to ask two questions. Anybody here that needs to receive this Christ? You say, yeah, Pastor, that was it. You hit the nail on the head. I don't have a relationship with him. I don't know him. Paul said, I want to know Christ, the power of his resurrection, the fellowship of sharing his sufferings. I just want to know Christ. Maybe that's you today. You just want to know him. We'll get you started. Help us help you get started on your journey to friendship with Christ. Like these young men did the other day. Like 2 weeks ago, before that, and the week before that. If you need this Christ, I just want you to raise your hand. I want to pray for you. I want everybody's head bowed for a minute. Let's give someone a little bit of space to think this through. Is there anybody here that needs to receive this Christ of which I speak and start your faith out fresh and anew? Raise your hand so I can see it. I want to pray for you. I'm not going to embarrass you. I want you to give this a lot of thought, what I'm about to ask you now. Church, I'm speaking to you now. A person who's a witness for Jesus Christ solely by living as Jesus lived has no voice. And a voice is essential. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of God. You can live the Word of God all you want, but if you never utter it and never share it, you have no voice. You're not sharing truth. That truth is not being shared with others. They're not receiving it. It's not penetrating them to dividing soul and spirit. It's not convicting them. Your lifestyle, while holy and noble, is not convicting people of their sin. You need a voice. That voice is absent in your ministry. If it's absent, I want you to raise your hand so I'll pray for you. That's all I'm asking you to do. Thank you. Thank you. Where's your voice? Thank you. Are there young men and women in this church that would say, Pastor, I'll be that person. I'll be the person in this church this week to go share the gospel with people. If that's you, raise your hand. Thank you.